It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, scientists are working on new painkillers that would be less addictive than many prescription drugs, and they're finding inspiration from venomous animals. We'll get the story with Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine.
Now, energy company Enbridge wants to expand its pipeline in northern Wisconsin. The Canadian oil and gas company currently has a pipeline that runs from Superior to Illinois, and now they're hoping to expand on that and add two more pipelines in Douglas County.
The company's proposed expansion of the existing pipeline would give it an even higher capacity than the Keystone XL pipeline, which sought a permit to bring tar oils across the border from Canada, but was ultimately rejected by President Obama last November.
An Enbridge spokesperson said the new plans have not yet been confirmed, but the proposal has drawn concerns from local residents, especially those with property on the pipeline's route. Here to tell us more about the plan is WPR Superior Bureau reporter Danielle Kading. Danny, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Veronica. How you doing?
Doing well, thanks. Well, first, tell us a little bit about what this plan calls for.
Okay, yeah. And it's actually not creating two new lines to Superior. There is an existing line called Line 3, and it was built in the late 60s. And that's transporting oil at a reduced rate to Superior right now because of concerns about that pipeline's integrity. They want to replace that line and then build right next to it a new line called the Sandpiper Pipeline, which would carry around 600,000 barrels of oil per day from the Bakken oil fields of North Dakota to Superior.
Okay, and so you've got that. And what about possible plans of running from Superior to Illinois?
Well, that is something that Enbridge has been looking into over the past couple of years. They started doing surveys with landowners about that potential, I think, in 2014. And then last year, they told their investors during an October conference that they are moving forward with potential plans for a twin pipeline to its Line 61 pipeline that runs from Superior to the Illinois border.
And how would the pipelines that Enbridge is planning for compare with the Keystone XL pipeline?
Well, the kind of question as to why Keystone is becoming an issue is because Enbridge is right now sending more oil across the U.S.-Canadian border than Keystone would have, and it's doing so through a maneuver at the border, switching oil between two pipelines, its Line 3 pipeline and its Line 67 pipeline, which is commonly known as the Alberta Clipper pipeline. So there's just concern in general about more oil coming from Canada to Superior and then going through Wisconsin to markets in the Gulf Coast.
Now, the Keystone XL pipeline, the decision for that was made at the federal level. It sounds as though the decision here with the Enbridge pipelines would be happening at the local level among local governments. What's the difference?
Well, it's not actually being made with local governments. There's a lot of different things going on with the Enbridge projects, which makes it really confusing and hard for people to know what's actually happening. And what happened is Enbridge was able to send more oil across the U.S.-Canadian border because it already had a presidential permit for its Line 3 pipeline. So instead of expanding its Line 67 line, which they are still looking to do that, but they haven't moved forward with that yet with the U.S. process at the border. Instead, they've decided to send that oil from its Line 67 pipeline through its Line 3 pipeline because they say they have the appropriate permitting. And so people are frustrated because they feel like Enbridge is getting around national environmental law through this maneuver at the border, and that in general they're just concerned because they're expanding a lot. They've got plans for Sandpiper and Line 3, and then this potential for another pipeline right next to Line 61. So people are just really concerned about more oil coming through the state.
And what kind of input might local governments and residents have in this?
So they have been trying to have local input where possible, which there's not a whole lot of avenue for that because most of what's regulated with pipelines is regulated under the Pipeline Safety Act, and that's federal government that deals with all of that. So what they've local governments, like Dane County, has tried to focus on is protecting their residents from the potential of a spill, like we saw with Kalamazoo in 2010. They don't want to see more than 800,000 gallons of oil spilled into any rivers here in Wisconsin. So they said, hey, pay us this special environmental insurance for building a pump station that would allow them to expand the amount of oil that they could send through the county. And Enbridge said that we've already got insurance, and that should cover everything. We're not going to get this special insurance. And part of the concern with that, I think, from the company's perspective, is that other local governments across the state might ask for this kind of insurance if they build another pipeline.
And where does that Dane County challenge stand?
Well, during the budget process last year, there was a provision that was slipped in at the last minute, and it prevents counties and towns from requiring this special environmental insurance. And critics of lawmakers have said that this was specifically tailored to Enbridge Energy, as well as another provision that changed the language as to who would be considered under eminent domain law, which they said favored Enbridge Energy and made it easier for them to take private property for that firm's use so that they could potentially expand this project to build a twin line to this line 61 that runs from Superior to Illinois.
Talking to Danielle Kading right now, WPR's Superior Bureau reporter, talking about a possible expansion of the Enbridge pipeline in northern Wisconsin. And Danny, the DNR released a 600-page environmental impact statement. What did it find?
Well, the statement goes through a lot of possible impacts based on three alternatives that the DNR has studied. And it's impossible to list them all, but of them, some of the potential impacts were impacts to scores of wetlands that are significant in Douglas County. It also cited four federally endangered or threatened species that might be affected by construction of Line 3 and the Sandpiper projects, including the gray wolf, the northern long-eared bat, which has been affected by white nose syndrome and is at risk, and also, ironically enough, a large sandpiper bird.
And if Enbridge does expand, going back to the permits necessary, what will it take for that to happen? Who needs to sign off?
So many people need to sign off on this. And that's part of the struggles that Enbridge has been facing with this, because there are a lot of people opposed to these pipeline expansions, not their customers, but environmental groups and tribal groups in Minnesota mainly have been really rallying against these projects and trying to hold them up. Enbridge is saying that that has been successful and that regulatory delays are preventing construction, that's delaying their timeline from 2017 when they hope to have everything built to 2019. So, you know, they're working through each state to get the proper permitting, and Wisconsin is a small piece of that, and they're really focusing more on Minnesota because that's where the majority of the project is located.
Is there any forecast for what kind of impact this would have on local economies in northern Wisconsin?
Well, under the environmental impact statement, I believe it says it would create 400 to 500 jobs during construction. And then also there's the spinoff jobs that would be created from that as a result of having those people employed in the area. So, you know, people who have long supported Enbridge see this as an economic boon for the area. But then people who are concerned about management of the state's sensitive natural resources or waterways are scared what more oil and construction in general might mean for those places that they value.
And there's a hearing on this, I gather, coming up this week. What are you expecting to see then?
Well, I'm expecting to see a lot of people from Madison, but also a lot of people from Superior, because there's a lot of people who are concerned about what this means as far as sending more oil across the state at a time when critics say we should be turning our attention away from oil to other sources of energy. Meanwhile, I Enbridge is definitely going to be there, and they'll be making their case. And I expect a number of trades groups and people supporting jobs in the area to come out and voice their support for the project as well.
Danny, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Veronica.
That was Danielle Kading, reporter at WPR Superior Bureau, telling us about a possible expansion of the Enbridge pipeline in northern Wisconsin.
A lot of prescription painkillers today are highly addictive or have negative side effects. In Wisconsin, authorities are cracking down on prescription painkiller abuse because it's been leading to addiction to heroin.
But scientists are working on new painkillers made out of animal venom that wouldn't have the same side effects as the medications we have now.
Gemma Tarlak is with us now to share the details of this and other science news. She's a senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. Gemma, welcome back.
Hi, how are you today?
Well, good. So animal venom, not something I usually think of wanting to be in me, but it, apparently it could be a good pain. So what is it about animal venom that would be good as a painkiller potentially?
Well, I think we need to understand a little bit about how pain works to really get the connection. And basically, pain is when it's your body's way of saying, hey, damage, danger, watch out. And what happens is the cells, they leak a small charge that travels through a pore and then through a channel. I'm really kind of super simplifying things.
Cliff's Notes version, yeah.
Yeah, if you think about it, there's a channel, and that channel carries the charge basically from the area that is experiencing the pain to the brain. And what they're doing is a lot of drugs out there, including the opioids, they work pretty much by disrupting the signals in your brain. And what they're looking at in venom painkillers, or venom-based painkillers, I should say, is because this venom, it works outside the brain, the chemicals in the actual venom from a lot of different animals. And I want to say it's not just any venom. It has to be a neurotoxin venom. So, you know, a lot of snakes, a lot of other animals, they tend to have hemotoxin venoms, and those actually destroy your red blood cells. Those are not good for painkillers, okay? So let's get that clear. But there are a lot of animals, especially spiders, that have these neurotoxins that block. They don't just block the channel that the signal travels to the brain, but they actually turn that switch off. So the signal never gets anywhere near the brain. And because of where they act and how they act, researchers think that they might be able to design drugs based on those same principles that would not be affecting the brain. In other words, the signals would never reach the brain, so there's no need to, pardon the pun, monkey around in the brain to stop the signals.
And I guess the theory here is that this kind of painkiller would not have the potential to be addictive. I guess it would just be in the system for as long as it's there and then exit.
Yeah, that's correct. Again, because it's working in the peripheral nervous system, not in the brain, not in the spinal cord, it is much lower risk. It has a much lower risk of either side effects or tolerance or addiction, which is great.
Is there a notion as to how soon we could see a prescription painkiller made out of animal venom hitting the market?
Well, there's actually one out there already. It's been out there for about a decade. The problem is it can only be administered through a spinal injection.
Ew.
And that's just because a lot of these peptides, these are the short amino acid chains that they're looking at within the venom as the potential source of painkillers. A lot of these peptides, they will just not survive in pill form. If you pop them in a pill and swallow them, they're going to be destroyed by your digestive system. It gets pretty juicy in there, you know. So what they're doing is they're looking at ways to take the peptides and put them in a different structure that we could digest and take a pill. And that there are several different researchers all over the world working on this. That is a good, I would say, 2 years away, at least in terms of clinical trials.
You mentioned spider venom. Any other sources?
Oh, yeah, there's centipedes and scorpions. There's even, you know, we hear about those awful red tides, especially off the southeastern coast of the country, that are, you know, killing just a lot of sea life and the poor manatees and everything. But they're actually looking at the red tide, which is caused by an algae. They're looking at the algae as a potential source of painkiller as well. So it's coming from a lot of really interesting places.
Well, speaking of the world of bugs and things like that, scientists are working on robotic bugs. So first of all, these are not robots. These are actually bugs we're talking about. What are we looking at in sort of this bug-robot hybrid?
Yeah, biobots, they're calling them. And you may remember a couple of years ago, there was this big flurry of interest in creating teeny tiny robots based on how bugs act in nature. Well, the researchers doing that realized it is really, really hard. Nature has it figured out way better than we do. So they started looking at taking actual insects, actual cockroaches, and a type of moth called a hawk moth, and taking those actual living creatures and basically hijacking their nervous system so that they could remote control them and get them to do things like investigate tiny areas where, say, after an earthquake, you know, an earthquake victim might be trapped and get a little robotic cockroach, a real living cockroach, but one wearing a teeny tiny backpack that has electronic devices that help the researchers control where it travels and how it reports back.
And for people who might be feeling sorry for the bugs at this particular point, wearing these backpacks with wires into their brains and being remote controlled, which sounds like a nightmare, apparently the bugs don't process pain the same way we do. Is that right?
Right. They don't have the same, you know, that was my concern, too. As soon as I started working on the story along with my editorial colleagues, and I was like, wait a minute, what about the poor, you know, poor insects? And they don't have pain sensors the way that we and other mammals do. And so these little bursts of electricity, they're basically just, they interpret them as environmental stimuli, like a bright light. Say the same way they would process a bright light is the same way they process the little electric stimuli that the researchers give them, and they're not like remote controlling them in the sense of just completely controlling the animal. What they're doing right now is showing it to turn left, turn right, go this way. So it's in the basic stages, and they say the animals really, you know, they don't experience the pain or the disorientation that we might worry about. But it could be incredibly valuable for, if you think about everything from, again, like earthquake victims, search and rescue teams made of like teeny tiny cockroaches, to everything from, you know, surveillance, keeping an eye on the bad guys with a hawk moth. That's kind of cool, I have to admit.
So one day we could literally be the fly on the wall.
Don't quit your day job.
But before we move on, I mean, does it work that well, this remote control, that we can actually pilot a moth reliably and not just keep whapping into the light fixture or the wall like an actual moth would?
Well, right now, it is in the early stages. The moth is in the very early stages. And one of the issues is just, even though it's a tiny amount of weight that they add on to the moth with its little backpack, it does mess its flight up right now. So they think in a couple of years, the electronics will be shrunk down enough that they'll be able to just put the little backpack on the moth and send it on its way. But right now, they're actually using balloons, which kind of cuts down on the surreptitious spy angle a little bit. If you see a moth with a balloon, you know. They think in a couple of years, yeah, this is something that they're going to work it out. And, you know, they're really advancing the research very quickly.
And finally, Gemma, you wrote a feature, 20 Things You Didn't Know About Marijuana. I guess it's in the news a lot, still a little controversial, but what did you learn while you were writing this?
Well, you know, the interesting thing, I wanted to write this because there is so much out there now, and it's mostly of a political nature, of a societal nature, and so there's a lot of talk about marijuana, but there's still a lot we don't know. And one of my one of the reasons this really interested me is because late last year, there was this landmark genetic study where they looked at a variety of commercially grown marijuana plants from all different sources, and they looked at them really on a genetic level. And they found out that they actually didn't know a lot about marijuana, either how it originated, what species was what, and it kind of tells you that everyone, you know, makes jokes about it. It's in pop culture a lot. It's now increasingly in politics, the issue of legalization, but we really, there's a lot we don't know about it, so I wanted to explore that issue.
Well, tell us a little bit about the history and prehistory of human cultivation and use of marijuana.
Well, we know for a fact that humans have been cultivating it for at least 6,000 years, and there's some evidence that it may be 12,000 years that we've been cultivating it, which is interesting because that would make it one of our very first crops, which, you know, is kind of curious. For a long time, it was eaten. It was used to weave fibers and other products, but almost from the earliest, the psychoactive nature of it was also remarked upon, and it's in a lot of texts. You know, probably most of us have heard about, you know, the ancient Hindu texts mentioning it as one of five sacred herbs. It's also in the very first medical text from China, but it's also in the Talmud, which is Judaism's key ancient text, and they found evidence of it in some of the big Egyptian tombs, including the one of the biggest ones of all, that of the pharaoh Ramses II. So it was like the ancient world was really kind of clued into it and making active use of it as a food, as a textile, and as a psychoactive drug.
What do we know about where it originally came from, and the word itself, too, for that matter?
Yeah, well, actually, the etymology of it is really fascinating because we got the word. You know, a lot of the world refers to it as cannabis, and Americans did, too, until the 19th century. And then we borrowed a Mexican term, and that Mexican term, marijuana, it's spelled a little bit differently, but there is disagreement whether that word originated in China, where parts of the plant are referred to as ma ren and ma hua, and apologies to any native Chinese speakers. I know that was a really bad pronunciation, but you get the idea. But other researchers think there's actually an Arabic origin of the word that may have arrived in Mexico via Moorish Spain. So there's a lot of disagreement about the word itself and about the plant itself. We think it came from Central Asia, but it may have come from South Asia. There's a lot of, you know, we're not really sure. It's a mystery, and they're just trying to figure it out on a genetic level, and
shrouded in
a lot of trouble.
Shrouded in a smoky haze of mystery. Gemma, thanks.
Always great to talk to you. Thank you so much.
That's Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. She joins us once a month with some of the most intriguing stories in science.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Growing up has never been easy, but our guest says today's social media has made coming of age in America faster, hypersexualized, and public. Sites and apps like Instagram, Vine, Kick, and Tinder are widely used, and in her new book, she makes the case that they're radically changing the way that teenagers grow up.
Nancy Jo Sales is an author and award-winning journalist. She's written for Vanity Fair, New York, and Harper's Bazaar. Her new book is called American Girls, Social Media and the Secret Lives of Teenagers. Nancy Jo, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. Well, how would you describe the change that social media has had on the lives of teenage girls?
Well, we have now teenagers using social media or consuming media, being on smartphones, tablets, computers, 9 to 11 hours a day. Some studies say every waking moment. And teenagers in studies say that they are, many of them are on social media almost constantly, quote unquote. So this is a big change in and of itself. The amount of time they're spending doing this as opposed to other things they might have done in the past.
Well, adolescence has always been, it's always had the potential to be a really horrible time. Hormones are out of control. You've got this excruciating self-awareness at the same time. So when social media enters that zone, what happens?
There's a lot of pressure on both boys and girls, but I think particularly girls, to present an image on social media, to take pictures of oneself that present an image that is, quote-unquote, perfect, and unfortunately, there's a lot of sexualization that goes on. Girls want to look hot. And so they're taking pictures of themselves and thinking about, what do I look like? And will I get likes? You know, girls tell me that it's all about the likes. You have to get likes. The kind of popularity contest that high school has always been has, you know, migrated onto social media, where other people validate you and judge you through likes and comments. And I think that this creates a lot of pressure. And girls in my book, I talked to over 200 girls all over the country, talked to me a lot about that.
And tell us about some of those conversations you had, because even though you were talking to girls of different races, social classes, living in different areas of the country, it sounded as though there were common themes that emerged. What were they?
Yeah, I was very struck by that, about how, you know, these platforms are the same. And so they're creating a kind of homogeneity of experience. And not all of it is very pleasant. You know, I talked to some girls in Cortona Park East, which is one of the poorest neighborhoods in the country, in the Bronx, and girls in Boca Raton, Florida, a very, very affluent neighborhood. And these girls were talking about things that happened online that were so similar. one of which was something called, well, it has a name, I'm not sure I can say on the radio, but these are these pages where not always boys, but typically boys will aggregate nude or semi-nude pictures of girls in their school or in their community, and who've sent pictures like this to someone who they maybe think is an intimate friend or partner.
And these are high school kids we're talking about.
Yeah, even middle school. And they will put all of these pictures on a page on Facebook or Instagram or other sites, and then it's up there for, you know, sometimes days, and everyone sees it.
And how does that affect these girls? I mean, I guess we don't know whether they consented to have their pictures being posted like that, but you have to assume that most of them didn't.
Most of them didn't. And this comes up in the news from time to time, and there's a hue and cry about it, and people say, oh, look at this high school, look at what's happening here at this place. But it's really very widespread. It's become very common. There was almost no school where I went to where this wasn't happening. And that's just one example of this kind of, I would call it self-generated sort of pornography that is a part of high school and middle school life now.
And you found the same thing in rural schools, too? If you were to look at rural Wisconsin, you would hear the same stories?
I didn't go to Wisconsin, per se, but I went to Indiana and Kentucky and Virginia and other places where there were girls in rural areas. And I think that what we're seeing here, again, is the technology is the same everywhere. You know, it's like girls in Wisconsin aren't Instagram the same way that girls in Florida or New York City are on Instagram. You know, they're using the same apps, which are, you know, have certain requirements for engagement, and one of which is posting pictures, liking, commenting, friending, unfriending. You know, there's all kinds of behaviors that go on these apps, which are the same no matter where you are or who you are.
We're talking with Nancy Jo Sales right now, talking about how social media has changed the way girls grow up. Her new book is called American Girls. And you say that this is primarily affecting girls for the most part, and your book is aimed at girls. What is it doing to boys, and why is it, do you think, disproportionately affecting girls?
Well, it was really girls that brought me to the subject of social media. I mean, I've written about kids off and on for about 20 years, and I had noticed that there were an awful lot of stories in the news about high-profile cases of cyberbullying, suicide, sexual assault, all these, you know, very, very sinister and sad things going on with the social media element. So I started talking to girls about it and heard from them about how this was a really much more widespread, I would say, epidemic problem among girls, not with necessarily these extreme outcomes, but on a day-to-day basis, girls were dealing with issues in their lives on social media that had similar themes, cyberbullying, sexual harassment, and, you know, of course, again, the sexualization of girls that goes on social media and just as part of its culture.
Today there is this big selfie culture, this culture of taking pictures of yourself and posting it on social media. The Kardashians, of course, leading the charge on that one. But as a starting point, it seems like it could be a wholesome thing, or at least a positive thing for self-esteem, to take a picture of yourself that you feel good about. So where does it go wrong?
Well, I think the problem is twofold. One is that these are images. This is not a whole person. We're offering images of ourselves. The girls are offering images of themselves up for what, because of the structure of these sites, amounts to validation. So you're saying, here's a picture of me. Do you like it? You know, it's interesting because one of the, you know, and people get to say yes or no, or you're hot or you're not. And very often the comments are sexualized too. You know, people will say hot, or, you know, they'll make comments that I can't really repeat on the radio. But I think that this, you know, sexualization is widely studied as being very damaging to girls. There's a landmark report about it done by the American Psychological Association about how it affects their self-esteem in a bad way, and also can have really, really serious consequences, like, you know, mental health issues, anxiety, depression. I saw, in interviewing girls, I saw an awful lot of anxiety related to social media use. And I think that this does affect them more than boys, because I don't feel that boys are necessarily judged or sexualized in the same way. Not that boys don't also suffer from some of these things, but let's face it, girls are more the targets of well, we know for a fact that they're more targets of cyberbullying. They're more targets of judgment. If you want to talk about the Kardashians, I mean, just today, there was in the news that Kim Kardashian posted a... I talk about her in my book because girls all over the country really look up to the Kardashians. And today, Kim posted a nude selfie.
That was in my news feed this morning. So there it is at the top, you know.
Yeah, well, I can guarantee you that in many middle schools and high schools around the country, that picture is a subject of discussion. And, you know, it's a part of the culture. You know, once upon a time, you know, we've always had celebrities. We've always had people who have influence over kids' lives for being famous for whatever reason. But social media stars now hold sway among kids more than regular stars. I mean, Kim is a much bigger star in a way than the average Hollywood actress. So what she does affects teenage culture and even middle school culture, you know? So I can guarantee you kids are talking about this picture, and I think that parents need to get involved in those conversations too. And I think one of the big questions for girls to ask and for parents to discuss with their daughters is, why is this person doing this? What is the goal of this picture? Why is nakedness? Why is a woman, and we don't see men doing the same thing, why is this woman doing this as part of her, you know, exercising her celebrity, if you will?
Do you think that girls who see that, if they're discussing it, do they then feel kind of pressure to follow suit, to, I guess, you know, keep up in a sense?
Well, I think there is a normalizing that goes on and is going on even today, and saying that, you know, this is normal. This is okay. You get attention. You get likes. Look at Kim. She's doing it. Well, she feels good about herself, so she's posting this picture. Isn't that great? You know, I do think it has an influence on girls and their feeling about what is essentially, I mean, one could argue, a kind of self-generated pornography again, being normalized and dismissed as just, you know, something that people just do now. And I think that we really have to think about what that says to girls, especially young girls, about what their value is. And what, I mean, we can tell them, you know, every day in every way possible as parents, you're valuable because you're smart and you're a good person and you're good at sports and because you do all kinds of nice things for people. But when a girl sees in our culture a woman being valued for all kinds of things except those wonderful things and for getting rewarded, then I think there might be a conflict in her mind about, well, what really is valuable? And I think parents need to talk to their daughters about this.
We're talking with Nancy Jo Sales right now. She's an author and journalist, and her new book is called American Girls, Social Media and the Secret Lives of Teenagers, talking about how social media has changed the way that girls grow up.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. How do you think social media has changed the lives of American teenagers? Do you see it having a negative effect on your kids, or do you see some upside? If you agree with our guest, what can we do to dial down the over-sexualized culture on social media? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking now with Nancy Jo Sales. She writes about youth culture for Vanity Fair and Harper's Bazaar, and her new book is called American Girls, Social Media and the Secret Lives of Teenagers. And we're talking about how social media has changed the way that girls grow up.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you the parent of a teen girl? Are you a teen girl yourself? How does social media work in your life? Do you see some of the negative things our guest is talking about? Bullying, growing up in public in some ways, hypersexualization? And if you do, what could we do about it? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Nancy Jo, I know you had conversations with 200 girls, and I'm sure at some point you've asked them, well, if you feel anxious, if it's not making you feel positive, why don't you stop using social media? What did they tell you?
That's a good question, and it came up in the very first conversation I had in my reporting, and I talk about it in the introduction to my book. The very first girls I talked to in Los Angeles, one of them said to me, social media is destroying our lives. And I said, well, why don't you go off of it? And one of her friends said, because then we'd have no life. And this sort of set the tone for the entire reporting, 30 months of reporting, because there were all these things that girls felt were really troubling and disturbing and challenging about social media. But at the same time, their culture is so enmeshed in it. I mean, again, 9 to 11 hours a day, social media and media consumption, this is where, as one girl said, this is where we live now. This is where we live. So it's almost like if you go off it, you are left out. You're left out of the conversation. You're not participating in where your culture is right now. I want to add one thing, though. There are many girls in the book who talk about the good side of social media. I mean, this is just a tool. It's not inherently good or bad. It's just a tool. And it's being used in ways right now which I think are really damaging to girls. But we can change that, and girls can change that, you know. It's just a question of, you know, I think starting the conversation about it. Girls in the book talk to me about, you know, all of the kind of positive outcomes they've had from using social media. And there's a black girl in the book who talks about becoming involved in the Black Lives Matter movement. There's a transgender girl who talks about finding support for her identity on YouTube. So, you know, and then there's also just the ways that they socialize and are playful with each other and communicate in all kinds of fun ways. But I think that's really overshadowed right now with a lot of things that are, I think, potentially very bad for them. And one of them is, you know, forget about these serious things like sexualization. One of them is just the constancy of it and how it's like an all-the-time thing. I mean, many girls felt very trapped in these sort of text groups where, you know, they have a friend group that will text, you know, pretty much constantly all day, and they're sending or receiving sometimes 100 or more texts a day. It's very distracting to schoolwork. It's very distracting to just your thoughts.
What is your sense in talking to these girls about how they understand the idea of feminism or women's empowerment and how that might relate to all of this?
A running thread throughout the book was feminism. I think that, you know, between 2013 and 2014, we saw, or I saw, even in talking to girls, interviewing them, a kind of an awareness, a kind of a waking up of feminist consciousness in the country. And that had a lot to do with, among girls, that had a lot to do with social media, too. And there were a lot of hashtags involving their concerns as girls and being, you know, being feminist, what is feminism. So you'll read throughout the book girls analyzing and discussing these notions and becoming aware, more and more aware, of how feminism plays a part in their lives and what it means for them. But at the same time, you know, when there's feminism and when there's an interest in feminism that sparks up, it's usually because, you know, something's wrong. Something's making us feel like there's too much sexism. And that's certainly what these girls, a lot of them, are feeling. Whether they would articulate in precisely that sense or not, these were things that were unfair or were degrading or were, you know, undermining in some way, and undermining to their empowerment. So this is a big, big theme in the book American Girls, and I think it's really an interesting subject for girls right now. I would hope that girls read the book as well as their parents. But parents in particular, I think, can help girls through these issues by understanding them a little better and just understanding how much girls are grappling with this right now.
Yeah, let's talk about that. Specifically, what would your advice be to parents if they want to help their daughters emerge from all of this feeling strong and good about themselves and not feeling anxious and having lowered self-esteem? What can they do?
I think they need to talk to them about it, and they need to talk to them with an informed perspective and just really understand, like, really what's going on social media and how much sexual harassment there is for girls, you know, and how much how much pornography there is. You know, the one thing we haven't really talked about is the influence of online pornography on social media. I mean, girls are and boys are likely to encounter a lot of sexually explicit material on social media. I mean, you know, Title IX established more than 40 years ago that the flashing of pornographic images in a certain, like a setting, like a workplace, is sexual harassment, and it's wrong. But this is what happens on social media. It's just, it's kind of this free-for-all. There's not, you know, we haven't had a lot of court cases establishing what's legal and what's not legal online and on social media. So, you know, chances are if your kid is on social media, they're on any of the top sites, they're going to encounter some pornographic image because a lot of the pornography websites advertise on there, and they might click on something, and, you know, there it is. I mean, in our Twitter feeds, we see all kinds of pornography all the time. And I think that parents really need to talk, be aware of this and talk to their kids about, you know, just sort of prepare them for it and talk to them about what it means, particularly since online porn is that we see today is not, I mean, if when you think of porn, if you think of like 1960s Playboys, you kind of have a lot of catching up to do because online porn now is very extreme and a lot of it's quite violent and I would say degrading to women.
So it sounds like the ground floor here is know what your kids are going through.
I would say so, and start having conversations. We have a website for the book that I think the publisher did a great job with called AmericanGirlsBook.com, and we have discussion guides for parents and discussion guides for girls, ways in which you can start having these conversations with each other, and also there's a place to share your stories so that girls can have, like, a place online where they can read about what other girls are going through, and parents can share as well.
Nancy, thank you.
Anonymously. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us. That was Nancy Jo Sales, author and award-winning journalist, author of the book American Girls, Social Media and the Secret Lives of Teenagers.
Last episode of the beloved Downton Abbey last night. Here's one of the most dramatic moments.
The kids are soft. They lack discipline. Well, I've got news for you. You are mine now. You belong to me.
All right, so that's actually a mashup, Rob, that you did.
Yeah, it's one of my works in progress.
Kindergarten Cop meets Downton Abbey.
Yeah, but you watched the actual thing like last night. No Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Right, he did not show up in Hip Check Carson or anything or Arrest Bates. Hmm. No, I thought it was a pretty mellow last show. It was very, you know, tying up of loose ends, people getting their happy endings, even the villains. Bates didn't get arrested. I'd call it a
spoiler
win.
Spoiler alert. Oh, well, people who have already seen it, I guess. So I watched some. I didn't make it all the way. You watched all the way through, and there was some dramatic twists and turns along the way, but this was not a shocker last episode, right?
No, this was very lovely. I think everyone on the show knew that they were part of something special and that this was a show that people had really taken into their hearts. And Julian Fellowes, the creator, really wanted to give them kind of a present to go away with a smile at the end.
So you think this is going to inspire more public TV type, you know, British-American productions?
Huh?
We'll see Downton Abbey 2, the Downtoning?
I hope so. It'd be fun to see a spinoff.
All right. Well, something to watch for. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time.